Einstein wheel for?
So I took this tremendous risk, and my suitcases were kept on the third floor of the house that I lived in, and at night when my sons were asleep, I crept up the stairs, and the stairs were squeaking, and I was afraid my parents would hear it, but apparently they didn't. I went up there, opened up the suitcases, and there was a little give on that wire that was put around the suitcase by the customs people, and put each stamp individually into the suitcases, the two suitcases that I was taking with me. I got all of my stamps in there. And I remember I wrote a note and said, my stamps are my picture albums. And I put that note in my father's desk. And when I, before I left Germany, when I was already on my way, my parents traveled with me to visit an uncle and aunt of mine before they put me on the train. I told them, when you get back home, I want you to look in the desk, in the middle drawer in the back. I left a note there for you. And my parents said, well, what did you write? Well, you just have to wait until you get back home. And then when I got to England and I opened up my suitcases and they were full of stamps everywhere, I had to shake everything out because there might be a stamp in there, I wrote to them my picture albums. I have arrived safely. And then my parents, of course, found that note, my picture albums are my stamps. And my parents were very upset with me, wrote to me and said, you don't ever do anything like this anymore, and so on. But it's those stamps that I sold because I didn't have any money really. And I, my parents didn't know that it came from the stamps. And so my parents were able to buy themselves something to supplement their horrible diet, which I'm very glad they were able to do. They didn't get all the money for every dollar or every shilling, I guess I should say. For every shilling that I'd sent, the Nazis probably kept 90% of it and only gave very little to my parents, but still, it was something. And the last amount that I'd sent, they never received because it arrived obviously after they were already gone from there, knowing when I sent it and having found out later when they were sent away. In July 1942, my mother was deported from that camp where both of my parents had been originally from Greece. She was deported to Camp de Rivesaltes, which is halfway approximately between Gurs and Le Mille, where my father was. And my mother writes a beautiful letter from there describing her trip from, I don't know if she was on a train or if she was on a truck, but she doesn't say, but they came past Lourdes and she got a glimpse of Lourdes. And she describes the beauty of Lourdes. And then apparently at some point she got a glimpse of the Mediterranean and she describes that. And she describes the undulating wheat fields and the oranges on the trees and the flowers and the other blooms that she's seen. And I just took that to believe that she was on a nice journey, and she wrote this beautiful letter describing all the things she saw. Never, because she didn't say anything bad. I wanted to believe that all was well. She just moved closer to my father. Maybe another one will move and they'll be together. And then I got a letter from my father written the 12th of August, 1942. Where he says, tomorrow I'm going to be deported to an unknown destination, and it may be a very long time before you hear from me again. And Then there was a letter from my mother written on September 1st, 1942. And I would like to read an excerpt of that into this tape, if I may. My mother writes in her letter dated September 1st, 1942, and I'm only going to read parts of the letter. She says, "It's very difficult for me to write to you today, but there's no use. It has to be done." And then she refers to the mail that she has received from me. And then she goes on, "The last few weeks have been very upsetting for all of us, but especially for me. Your dear Papa was deported from Pont de Mille on August 12th, and unfortunately, I do not know where he was sent. The last mail I had from him was dated August 9th, in which he expressed the hope that somewhere en route we would meet, because the transport from here left at the same time for an unknown destination. I remained here because your dear Papa lately was a forced laborer. And that's the only time that I've heard that mentioned. I never knew that. But now there is another transport leaving from here, and this time I am leaving on it. My only hope is that I will still meet dear Papa somewhere, and then we will carry our lot, no matter how difficult it may be, with dignity and with courage. My dear good child, I will try in every way possible to remain in touch with you, but it will probably be a long time before we hear from each other again." And then still later in the letter she says, "Continue to be always good and honest, carry your head high, and never lose your courage. Don't forget your dear parents. We shall continue to hope that one day we will see each other again, even if it takes a long time. My dear good child, let me greet you and kiss you heartily. I will never forget you and deeply love you, Mutti." And then there was one more postcard that I got from my mother, dated September 4th. And it is mailed in Montauban, which was northwest from where she was at the time. But she writes in the postcard, and it's real shaky handwriting, "Traveling to the east, sending you from Montauban many loving farewell greetings." That doesn't really express it as strongly as what she's saying. What she's actually saying is a very final goodbye. It's not possible to translate that into English the way it is said in German. And I, being in the denial stage, I, until not too long ago, until just a few years ago, read that postcard to read "traveling in an easterly direction," and that she's saying, goodbye, and be seeing you again soon because I'm going on a trip. And it's very clear what she's saying, but I did not want to understand that. And I think that was my coping mechanism. Had I understood or tried to understand, I don't think I could have really survived it. And so I waited and waited and waited. And how long is a long time? Is it a week, a month, a year, 10 years? And I decided maybe I need to wait until the war is over. And then the war was over, and I didn't hear. And so then I made all kinds of excuses. I've moved several times, and the post office may not have forwarded the letters. They perhaps have lost my address. Maybe they're suffering from amnesia. Maybe they don't know how to find me, but someday I will find them. And it wasn't, well, I went back to Germany after the war was over, and I will talk more about that later. And I was in Germany until 1948, March 1948. I was not able to go back to the village where I came from until the summer of 1947, because, and I think the reason I was not able to is, had I gone back before, I would have had to admit that they are not there. This way, I could still fool myself. Maybe they're in Kippenheim. But if I go there and they're not there, I can no longer use that. And so finally, at one time, I actually was on the train going there, and when the train stopped the first time, I got out and went back to where I was, because I couldn't handle it. But finally, in August of 47, I said to my stay in Germany is coming to an end, and I either go there to Kippenheim, or I won't go there, but I've got to decide, and so I decided to go, and of course, they were not there. But that still didn't make me realize or understand or accept what may have happened to them, because I still kept on hoping to hear. And I, while I was in Germany, I visited displaced persons camps, and I tried to all kinds of organizations to find out where they are. I looked at all kinds of lists, and they weren't on any lists. In 1956, I received two letters, one pertaining to my mother, one pertaining to my father, from a French organization, which stated that on the 11th of September 1942, both of my parents were sent from a camp in France, from Drancy, which I later found out was sort of a transit camp where everybody from all over France was brought there before they were sent on to concentration camps or extermination camps in Poland. That my parents were sent on the 11th of September 1942 to Auschwitz. That was the first time that I had that much concrete evidence. And so I still said, well, people survived, and they may have survived. And I still kept on hoping to hear from them. In 1980, I visited the various camps where my parents were, not all of them, but some of them. I visited Kornbluth, I visited Dachau and Auschwitz. And when I was stood in Auschwitz on the ramp where the decision was made by the camp administration as to who will live and who will die, that's when I finally, suddenly accepted the fact that my parents indeed are no longer alive and did not survive this. This was September 1980. Very long time. I think before I probably intellectually knew, but emotionally couldn't accept it, but by September 1980 I was able to emotionally accept it. Last year, the fall of 1990, the Soviet Union released some information about what happened to people in various concentration camps, including Auschwitz. And it was possible to fill out a questionnaire with the American Red Cross, which would be sent to an international tracing service in Germany. And I immediately got those forms, but I didn't fill them out. I wanted to, and I didn't want to. And in June of 1991, I was in Germany on a speaking tour and realized at one point that I was very close to where this international tracing service is and decided to go there. And I met a marvelous woman there, a warm, loving, kind, sweet, gentle woman, and with her help, I was able to fill out the application form to see if that information that was released would give some information about my parents. She told me it probably wouldn't, because the information basically are death certificates, and death certificates were issued only on people who lived in Auschwitz for a length of time and then died for whatever reason. And my parents, probably by the time they got to Auschwitz, if they even survived that trip, probably went straight to the gas chambers, because they had almost 2 years of camp experience behind them and probably were not in very good condition. And so probably I won't find out anything. And this woman said I would have to wait about a year to hear, because they've had so many requests and they're going to take them in the order they received them. So there was even as late as this 1990-91 some denial on my part, so, or trying to deny, or trying not to want to know and yet wanting to know. And I'm not sure, you know, what I'll find out. I think I know, but I'm not sure how I will deal with that. That's still something to be seen. Maybe I need to talk about myself in England. I remained in school and remained with the Simmons family until July of 1940. Mrs. Simon, who paid for my board and lodging, informed me shortly before my birthday, my 16th birthday, in August of 1940, that in England one only has to go to school until one is 16 years old. And since I was going to be 16 on August 15th, I needed to drop to, when at the end of the school year, which was the end of July, I needed to drop out of school and go to work and earn my own living so that I could have a roof over my head and be able to support myself. And I was just absolutely flabbergasted and shocked. I mean, here I was supposed to go on to college and I hadn't even finished high school yet. And dropping out of high school, I had never heard of anything like that. And what would my parents think? But I couldn't and wouldn't tell them. I could, but I wouldn't tell them that. And I said, I don't know how to find a job. I have no skills. I don't know what I can do. And so she said, well, I'll see if my daughter can help you. And she would always call on her daughter. And so Mrs. Mayer found a job for me with a cantor who lived on the same street as she did, who was either divorced or separated. And he had a 14-year-old daughter who lived with him. And he wanted me to be a companion to this 14-year-old girl who had really no friends. She was a nice little girl, but she had no friends. And so I was to walk her to school and try to pick her up from school. And my other job was to dust in the house. It was a big house, to dust the furniture every day. And that was basically my duty. And I would have free board and lodging that way and got 5 shillings a week. And I thought I was on my way to being a millionaire, because I never had so much money. I still have the 10 marks from Germany. I hadn't touched them because nothing really terrible had happened that I needed them for. And shortly after I got there, the air raids started, the heavy raids started. I remember, I believe it was on a Saturday evening, we looked out the window to the east and the sky was all red. It was when the East End was on fire, the East End of London was on fire. And it looked as though the sun were setting, but the sun doesn't set in the East. We spent, when the raids then became fairly regular, a shelter was built inside the garage. And there was the household there consisted of the cantor, his daughter, myself, but there was also another man living there who was a refugee from Germany and a friend of the cantor. But so there were, I assumed that 4 barracks would be built in the shelter, but there were 5 barracks built in the shelter. And so I had to rationalize that, and so I thought, well, maybe his wife is coming back, and that's why. And once a week, on Fridays, a woman who has, whose husband also was a cantor, she and her husband also were refugees from Germany, but her husband was interned in the Isle of Man. This woman came on Friday morning and cooked a meal for the Sabbath meal and some meals that we could warm up during the rest of the week. And then she always stayed on Fridays and had the Sabbath meal with us. And then I don't really know what happened because the girl and I would leave and could we play or do something. And so that was it. But then we moved into this shelter and we finally decided when the raids came fairly regularly and lasted a good part of the night, we just are going to sleep in the shelter instead of going to the shelter and then going back to the bedroom. And one night I woke up in this shelter and there were 2 double bunks and a single bunk. And something was going on in this single bunk. I didn't know what it was. I sort of risked one eye and was petrified. And the next morning, the little 14-year-old girl said to me, "Was there a lot of bombing last night?" And I knew somehow intuitively that she probably saw and heard something and wanted me to explain it to her. But I didn't know what it was, and I didn't want to admit that I didn't know. And so I said, "I don't know. I slept all night. I have no idea." But whatever went on in this bunk went on then night after night after night. I became increasingly more fearful. And so one day when I was alone in the house, I called Mrs. Mayer, and I said to her, "I can't stay here any longer." She said, "Why not? What is wrong now?" And I said, "I don't want to witness a murder." And she didn't ask me to explain anything, but she said, "Are you there alone?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Start packing your suitcase. I'll be right over." And I said, "But I have to pick up the little girl from school soon." "Never mind. Don't worry about it. I will take care of everything. Go to your room, start packing, and open the door when I ring the doorbell, and I will be helping you over here." So I went back to Mrs. Mayer's house again. And she told me never to have any contact with this family, that everything's been taken care of, and not to worry. And I stayed with her for a few days, with her and her family. And then she placed me into a girls' hostel on Belsize Park, in Belsize Park, actually. And it was on Belsize Park. Number 27, Belsize Park, was the main address. But there were 3 houses, and I was put in the house number 46, Belsize Park. This hostel, there were the women, because some of them weren't really girls, they were women. They were women in their 20s, some of them even older. I was at that time the youngest to arrive there. After that, they even took younger girls. We were all refugees from Germany. And the home was run by a Mrs. Glicksman, who was herself a refugee from Germany. And she was a rather exploitative woman. She took whatever she could from us and gave little in return. The meals, for instance, I don't think I ever knew what I ate. Everything was ground up something. It was never recognizable. For instance, the building that I lived in number 46 Belsize Park, in the winter, there was no heat. And when the pipes froze, there was no water. Number 27 on the 3rd floor is where Mrs. Glicksman lived. That building was heated because she wanted heat. And I, after quite some time, I was successful in being able to move into number 27. So at least I had some heat, I had some warm water, I had water to wash myself, to wash my clothes. I mean, I remember having literally a brown crust on my body during the winter, my clothes being having some unrecognizable gray color because I had no way of washing while I lived in number 46. We sometimes got candles and we would put our hands around the candles to keep warm. Anyway, when I arrived there, I was placed in this room with, there was eight of us in this room. And I was told that the women in this room don't really speak English, so I'd have to talk German to them. And this was the first time that I was going to talk German. I hadn't talked any German, though I wrote letters in German to my parents. I hadn't spoken German. And so I should introduce myself when I get there. So I walk in, and I'm trying to tell them who I am. And I wanted to say I am the new girl in this room. And instead, I said, I am the new maid. And they immediately showed me where the broom and the mop was. And I started to cry. I am not a maid. But that's what you told us. And so that was just very temporary. And I was the youngest one in that room. And they wanted to know, of course, what happened, where was I, and why did I leave? And so I told them that I didn't want to witness this murder. And they all started to laugh. And I said, it wasn't funny. I mean, how would you like to witness a murder? And so this one woman, she was probably about 20, took me aside and explained some of the facts of life to me. And I said to her, you have a dirty mind. My parents wouldn't want me to associate with you. I am never going to talk to you ever anymore. And she said, how do you think your parents had you? And I said, I don't know, but not that way. And for a long time, I didn't talk to her. Eventually, I did learn some more and realized that what she was telling me was not dirty, but was were the facts of life. This Mrs. Glucksman ran a doll factory in this home where she employed some of the people that lived in the home, and I started to work there, so I learned how to make dolls and how to make dolls' clothes. I learned how to sew on a sewing machine, where I finally learned some skills. And after I had done this for quite some time, and I don't remember exactly when, though I still have my alien registration book from England, and I could probably verify the dates from that, another woman, young woman, who also worked in the doll factory with me, she and I decided we're going to strike out, and we're going to find a job someplace else using our sewing skills. And we both got a job at Harrods, and in the department where they were making children's clothes. In fact, that department made the clothes for the now Queen of England and Princess Margaret. But we weren't allowed to do that because those clothes had to be perfect. And I learned how to smock there. And I believe it was in 1943. Late 1943, I decided that I really needed to do something about the war effort, and I needed to work in a war factory and contribute something to the war effort. And so I left Harrods and started and worked in a factory. And the first job that I had, I was put on a manual press, and I worked that press for about a week, and I thought, I need to do bigger things, more important things. And so I had no idea what I was doing on this machine. Nobody knew what we were doing. And I asked the foreman on the Monday of the second week there if I couldn't be put on one of the bigger machines and do something more important. And so he said, well, I can put you on a power press. And he showed me how to use it. And I had an accident on that machine because the machine was defective, which he knew and didn't tell me. And I lost the tip of my right index finger. And I was not able to work for about 7 weeks. And then I had joined the union during that first week, and the union helped me find another job. And the company had to pay me my wages the 7 weeks that I wasn't working, and they were very angry when I then didn't come back. But I found out that there were several defective machines in this shop, and several other people had been hurt, and so I did not want to go back there. And then I worked in another factory. We were making bullets. It was very obvious we were making bullets. And we were rotated. There were different things you did to these bullets, and we were rotated so that nobody ever did anything for any length of time, I guess to avoid boredom. And after I was there, by the way, I remember this very clearly, on D-Day, the 6th of June, 1944. I remember hearing the planes overhead, one after the other. After I was there about a year,